This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Welcome to episode 199 of the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast.
Why are you singing?
I got the blues, Nick.
Okay.
I got the blues because I've been watching a television show that I was not prepared for. As we head into tonight's episode, because this is HTF 199, we are one away from HTF 200, which is what 199 means. And we are bringing to you our own Fantabulous Emancipation. Isn't that right, Nick?
Yes. Actually, that's next week.
Ah, yes. Or the Fantabulous Emancipation of Two, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke. Ah. But nonetheless, that notwithstanding, we are here to talk about something. You know, there's a big movie coming out this weekend that is called Birds of Prey, parentheses, or the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
You keep saying this. Is that actually Fantabulous? Is that actually?
Yes.
Is that the actual word?
That's the actual title. Don't question me.
Fair enough.
Don't ever question me.
I was just wondering.
You know who questioned me? You know who questioned me? The Franz Ferdinand, and he was killed.
The Archduke Franz Ferdinand, he was. That's true.
He doubted me.
Well, I don't know what to say.
Mikhail Gorbachev doubted me, and the Soviet Union is no more. So don't doubt me, Nick. That's what I'm getting at here. So we are here to talk about we are going to do an episode of Off the Page. Actually, we're going to call an audible, and we're going to do a Fix It or Nix It.
Oh, God.
On an episode of the television series Birds of Prey, which came out in 2002 on UPN. Isn't that something, Nick? UPN? Remember UPN?
I do. SmackDown was on it for a time.
It was. Back when they had the theme song of Hoo da, hoo do, hoo da, hoo do, hoo da, hoo do, hoo da.
Wasn't it on UPN during the Beautiful People era, too?
It may have been. I don't know. But it was certainly on during that era.
Which, that was the best. That was the best SmackDown intro.
Oh, you're talking about the Beautiful People was by far the best SmackDown song.
Yes.
I still think of that as the definitive SmackDown song. Because that was right. The SmackDown song when they moved over into the Fist era, right? Or was it gone?
I believe so. I don't remember, though.
I just remember it being an awesome song. It got you pumped up to watch the show. But I believe it was that they moved into the Fist era with Beautiful People around 2001-ish. And and by gosh, it was a fun show in those days. Well, nonetheless, we're not here to talk about SmackDown from 2001, which would probably be a more entertaining episode, actually. We're here to talk about Birds of Prey. You know, the big movie's coming out this weekend, Nick. And, you know, interestingly, we batted around the idea of doing a comic book, but we knew that a TV series would take far less effort. And so that's why we did it. But from a quality standpoint, we probably should have chosen the comics. Now, I myself have not read too many Birds of Prey comics in my day. It's always kind of been just off my radar. In my comic reading life. Have you read any Birds of Prey in your time, Nick?
Very little. Whenever they did Rebirth, I read, you know, the first couple issues of that because I was trying literally every Rebirth series because that was during a time when DC had as much of my goodwill as they've ever had. And of course, 2 years later, they squandered it. So, you know, so only a few issues of that, really. No, actually, I read a lot of that. I stayed on that book. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey. Yeah, it was Batgirl, Huntress, and Canary. And I remember, yeah, because it was by the Benson sisters who, you know, we kind of had a little debate around here around that time about the quality of that book. I know Jennifer Smith wasn't as high on it as I was. And then, yeah, but that was a fun little book. So, yes, I read most of the Rebirth run.
Well, very good. So you have a little bit more knowledge then, at least going in, of the Birds of Prey than I did in this project. Of course, this isn't based on that. This is based on the original Birds of Prey comics by Chuck Dixon and Jordan B. Gorfinkel.
God. And what?
I didn't know this, but according to this, the co-creator of Birds of Prey is Jordan B. Gorfinkel.
Okay. If you say so.
God, we're so unprofessional, Batman. I mean, Nick, you're not Batman. You're Nick.
What a compliment. Thank you.
Gorfinkel was an editor at DC Comics for nearly a decade, where he managed the Batman franchise. His most notable additions to the Batman universe include Birds of Prey and Batman No Man's Land. So he must have been part of that editorial group with Denny O'Neil and company. Nonetheless,
yeah, that sounds about.
He's credited as a co-creator of Birds of Prey. Anyway, so this is based on those Dixon comics that really kind of shine a light on the team that you hit on earlier. It was Barbara Gordon as Oracle. At this point, of course, this is many years after she was shot and paralyzed by the Joker. And she's kind of the team leader, I guess you would say. And with her are the Huntress, Helena Bertinelli in the comics. And, of course, Dinah Lance, the Black Canary. Or Dinah Drake, I suppose you would say. I don't know. Which one was it at that time, Lance or Drake?
Green Jacket, Gold Jacket, who gives a shit?
I'm going to assume it was Dinah Lance, but I don't know that to be 1,000%.
Maybe it was Dinah Redmond.
You know, it could have been, Nick. It could have been Dinah Redmond. So this show came out in 2002. I believe it premiered, if I am not mistaken, October 9th, 2002, exactly 1 year after the premiere of Smallville, which had been a hit. This was an attempt to capitalize on DC Comics. Kind of an unusual attempt, I think. Which this was an era of unusual attempts, because you've got a Superman show going on that's already had some success, and it is based on a Clark Kent who is not Superman yet. He's a boy, a teenager, in fact. Doesn't wear the suit, doesn't do costumed heroics. And you would think that if you were going to take a Batman property and turn it into a show, you might just do a young Batman show, right? Well, no, they didn't do that. They went a different route here. They wanted to focus on the Birds of Prey, and yet very much set it in the world of Batman. And so here we have it, debuting on UPN, October 9th, 2002, executive produced by Michael Tolan, Brian Robbins, and Joe Davila. And kind of an interesting cast here of actors and actresses. I was kind of surprised by some of the people I saw popping up here along the way. Your lead characters are the elder statesman here is Barbara Gordon, a.k.a. Oracle. They are going with the Oracle story, which to this point in time, Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, is the only time we've ever seen Oracle in live action.
Yeah, pretty sure that still holds true to this day, does it not?
I believe so. That's my understanding. And she is played by Dinah Meyer. And Dinah Meyer was an actress whose name was more familiar for me than when I saw her face. But I have seen her in a few other things. She was in Star Trek Nemesis. And she did have a recurring role in Beverly Hills 90210. So that may be where I first saw her. But nonetheless, she plays Barbara Gordon. And
yeah, you knew a lot of these like fringe actresses from this time. I was surprised.
I did. And she didn't do a bad job of playing Barbara. We'll get to that.
We'll get to that, yeah.
Ashley Scott plays the Huntress, which is – they're going with the original Huntress idea from the 70s, which is that she is the daughter of Batman and Catwoman. For those who don't know, the original Huntress was an Earth 2 character that was the daughter of Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle on Earth 2, who becomes the Huntress – and seeks out retribution.
But there is a little bit of a difference there in that I believe the original Earth 2 version, like, she knew her parents, like she had a relatively positive relationship with them. You know, it wasn't this.
They're killed take on and it. She's angry and all that stuff, right? But she, nonetheless, that notwithstanding, this is the version that they chose to go with, and they end up with this character of Helena Wayne, aka the Huntress. I'm sorry, Helena Kyle.
Nope. Well, Kyle, yes.
AKA the Huntress. And the gimmick here is that she is the daughter of what appears to be the Michael Keaton Batman and the Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman, but Batman never knew she existed. Never knew that he had a daughter. And
never knew that she'd been deceived, yes.
And Catwoman.
Which, if we're going with the movie canon, then apparently at some point off camera during the events of Batman Returns, that means they had sex and conceived this child, and then the fetus survived the taser makeout with Christopher Walken at the end of the movie. And he gave birth.
Now, how can we be sure that she's not Max Schreck's kid?
That's a great point.
Maybe she's Helena Schreck. That's a great point.
Helena Schreck.
But
well, then she'll need to get. Then she'll need to go find her long lost brother, that dude during the Chris Walken impression from Batman Returns.
Father, what are you doing? You have a daughter. She's been there the whole time.
What an awesome movie.
So Selena Kyle raises her daughter apparently for many years. And then, in a fit of retribution, the Joker murders Selina Kyle, which we'll get to in a minute, and leaves Helena an orphan, and she somehow ends up in the care of Barbara Gordon, and AKA Oracle, and becomes the crime fighter known as the Huntress. So we'll get to we'll touch. Oh, and she also, this is very important, she has superpowers because her mother, as you may remember from the film Batman Returns, has cat powers because she was licked back to life by a pack of cats that somehow had magical abilities. And her mother comes to life and has nine lives, right? And one of her seemingly uses her eighth life, I suppose it was, to destroy Max Schreck with the taser kiss that was mentioned by Nick a moment ago. And anyway, her daughter has inherited these abilities. She can jump really high. You know, she can move really fast. Her eyes turn into cat eyes at times. Presumably, if she's anything like my cat, she likes to go and eat food and then lay in the corner and sleep all day and do nothing else with her life. So, you know, all the abilities of a cat. And then you've got Rachel Skarsten, who is playing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it says here, Nick, Dinah Redmond, in parentheses, it says, nay, Lance.
See, they change it like four times. So you haven't watched the second episode, but they reveal that her name was...
Of course I have.
Originally, like, when she first shows up, she's Dinah Drake, and then she's revealed to be Dinah Redmond, so I guess they later reveal her to be Dinah Lance?
I guess so. Anyway, listeners of this podcast will most know Rachel Skarsten for her role as Beth Kane, aka Alice in Batwoman. So that's kind of where she's made her bones, or so to speak, where people may recognize her. At this time, she was a youngling. Apparently, she was around the age of 17, playing a very young version of Black Canary.
She was 17,
and Black Canary is a character that typically in the comics has been presented as being a little older. So that was kind of an unusual approach to the character. Here's some other interesting names that people will recognize. Shamar Moore, a man who has been in all kinds of things. I knew him from The Young and the Restless when I was a kid, and he ended up being incredible.
Oh my God. That explains your Shamar Moore
shut
obsession.
Up.
The Young and the Restless. Good God.
He was one of the young at the time. He was one of the young.
Most people would know him from, I believe, Criminal Minds.
Criminal Minds, and he was in SWAT as well. He has won 8 NAACP Image Awards.
I think SWAT is still a thing.
He won the 2000 Daytime Emmy Award for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Drama for his role in The Young and the Restless, you son of a bitch. Why don't you put that in your stinger pipe and smoke it, brother?
I don't care if he won an award for it. I'm not going to watch
the Young and the Restless. He was the voice of Victor Stone, a.k.a. Cyborg, in the DC animated movie universe that they're doing right now. The Reign of Superman.
I didn't know that.
He's also a very attractive man. What can you say? Come on.
The Restless.
There's nothing wrong with The Young and the Restless. You're just
What about Days? Are you a Days of Our Lives fan too?
Yes, Days of Our Lives is the best, actually. It's the GOAT.
General Hospital. No, what are the other ones? I forget.
General Hospital, As the World Turns, Guiding Light. And don't forget about Passions, which was short-lived. But had the midget with the witch.
How could I forget about Passions, Greg?
Yeah, it had a midget and a witch on it.
Clearly one of my favorites.
I mean, a small person and a witch.
I was a big soap opera watcher back in the day.
Should have been. You would have turned out better. But I'm sorry, that was harsh, Nick. I apologize. That was mean.
Oh my God! Don't apologize. I'm mocking you for watching soap operas.
Well. Nonetheless, I'd defend to the death your right to do it. That's not true. I wouldn't defend it to the death. But nonetheless, back to the point at hand. Shamar Moore, hell of a man. And then Ian Abercrombie. Ian Abercrombie as Alfred Pennyworth. He, of course, has been in all...
Am I supposed to know who that is?
He's in Seinfeld. He's in Desperate Housewives. He played Palpatine in Star Wars, The Clone Wars.
Oh, did he? That's good to know.
Yes. Ian Abercrombie's had a rich career of being, and his name is Ian Abercrombie, for God's sake. How could he not have a rich career? He was in 3 episodes of Fantasy Island. He was in The Happy Hooker Goes to Hollywood.
Now, wait, they're doing Fantasy Island, you know, the reboot, the big screen reboot, as a horror film, and yet they're not going to have Tattoo in it. And he was the scariest part of the original Fantasy Island.
Tattoo was awesome. Also, Tattoo was great in that one Bond movie, The Man with the Golden Gun.
It was off-putting. Yes, he was off-putting and everything in all of those things.
There's nothing off-putting about Tattoo.
A little bit.
He's good. And he was...
He's fine.
Anyway, Ian Abercrombie plays an old, kindly Alfred Pennyworth here. And...
Are you just going to say Ian Abercrombie over
I love
again?
His name. Mia Sara! Oh, Nick,
freaked out about this earlier. I do not know who this person is.
Mia Sara, Nick. Oh, my God. Let me tell you about Mia Sara. Mia Sara was one of the stars of one of the first nude scenes I can remember in a movie. Oh man. Time Cop with Jean-Claude Van Damme. If you haven't seen Time Cop, Nick, go and rent or watch somehow the movie Time Cop. A, it's a good movie. B, it's got Jean-Claude Van Damme spin kicking guys in the past and the future. And C, it's got Mia Sara's physique in it, and it's awesome. She's amazing. He's amazing, too. Van Damme's in it. You get to see his rippling muscle. It's amazing. It's a great scene. And as a 10-year-old boy watching it, it awakened me to things in the world, Nick. Not quite to the same degree that Highlander The Final Dimension did, but nonetheless, it was one of the great rentals of its time. And
Craig is just running down like the discount bin.
Time Cop was not a discount movie. Time Cop was a great movie. Also,
I'm aware of that. I'm aware.
You may know her from the movie Legend with Tom Cruise. She played the love interest. She was also apparently the lady and the girl in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Remember, he has a girlfriend in that movie, apparently.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, that's her.
Okay.
That's her.
Oh, yeah.
Mia Sara. She's very young at that time. Yeah. Anyway, Mia Sara is awesome. I can't believe they got her in this role. She plays Harley Quinn. She plays Dr. Harlene Quinzel, who we don't find out until later on.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Harley Quinn. And shall we say a very unique take on Harley Quinn, Nick? And by unique, I mean...
Yeah, she just walks...
As generic as it gets.
Yeah, just walks around talking like a normal person.
And the first episode...
Says things about being a psychopath without actually, you know, demonstrating any psychopathic tendencies.
Well, she does punch that guy in the face, or kick him in the face, I should say, at the end.
Yeah.
But then what about the guest star in the first episode that only appears briefly in the beginning and plays an absolute creep? Aaron Paul of the television series Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Aaron Paul of Breaking Bad fame tries to rape Rachel Skarsten early in the episode.
And he pays for it, although they let him get away. I don't understand that. He just runs off, Nick. And Huntress is like, yeah, it's all right. Ugh. Kick his ass, Seabass.
Well, she did kick his ass.
Yeah, but then she let him run away. She didn't give him to Shamar Moore and company. Shamar Moore plays a cop, by the way. I should have mentioned that. He plays a cop named Detective Jesse Reese, Knee Hawk. I don't understand all this
what?
Shit. That's what it says
why
here.
Why does everyone have...
Everybody has three names on the show.
Different names. My God.
It's too much does
everyone
to
have
up.
Serious backstories, I guess?
Let me tell you, if they wanted this show to succeed, they should have taken this image that's on the Wikipedia page and just use that to market the show. Good Lord. Anyway, where was I at, Nick?
I don't know. We were talking about Aaron Paul was in it.
Aaron Paul was in it.
You're talking about the guest.
Paul George was in it.
The cast.
Paul George was in it, I'm sure. Aaron Neville was probably in it at one point.
Good Lord.
Neville Chamberlain was in it, I believe. Wilt Chamberlain was in it. Walton Goggins.
The man that gravity forgot, Neville was in
Neville,
it.
Neville, yes. Walton Goggins.
No. The man that gravity forgot, Neville. Not Neville. You got to remember, there's a...
Ah, yes, the man that gravity forgot, Neville. Colon. Is that anything like the bastard Pac, or are they different?
No, it's more akin to the extraordinary man who does extraordinary things, Finn Balor.
No, you didn't say it right. It's the extraordinary man who does extraordinary things. Totally different. Two different businesses, pal. Now...
What are we talking about?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. Yes, Birds of Prey. So,
yeah,
this show has gained somewhat of a reputation over time as being god-awful, a horrible attempt at a show.
Yes.
It didn't even last an entire full season. I think it may have just lasted its 13-episode run, and then it was killed.
13, yeah. It was one of those – they still do this to this day, you know, where like I believe the first season of Black Lightning was 13 episodes, and then like they added like six to the end of it. Or what? Are you okay?
I just read the description of episode 12. They fight Clayface. There's a Birds of Prey version of Clayface.
My God. Anyway, and so it made it to the end of its initial order, and that was it. No more was ordered, and yeah, I don't want to give anything away this early, but I would say with good reason.
Yes, it's bad. It's one of those shows that Nick talked about this off the air to me, that lived down to its hype. And that's rare on this show. We often review bad movies, TV shows, etc. And very rarely are they as bad as we've heard.
Yeah, like, for example, the Fantastic Four 2015 movie that, you know, we were told for years was one of the worst comic movies of all time. And then I watched it, and I was like, it's really bad, but I don't know. I think over the
I hated it more than Nick did.
Sure, yeah, I'm just saying, but like with things in general, I think the more time that goes by and the more that reputations are cemented, it becomes difficult for things to meet the level of hyperbole that is often out there in the fandom. Like, for example, Greg, if someone had never seen the 2011 Green Lantern movie before, or 2009 Green Lantern movie, I'm sorry.
No, it was 2011, you had it.
2011, yeah. If somebody had never seen it before and then watched it next week, I don't really – like, I think a lot of people would probably walk away from it going, man, that was bad, but it wasn't as bad as it's been made out to be.
Right.
And I feel that way about a lot of things that we've watched for this show that have these negative reputations.
Right.
This was the rare exception where I understand everything that has been said about it.
Yes. So the show's plot, as it is – revolves around, as I mentioned.
Yeah, they have a lot of backstory. They just dump on us in the first like 3 minutes of the show.
A lot of backstory, and the backstory is that Batman and the Joker had one final confrontation for the fate of Gotham City, and Batman won. We are told, and a building collapse around them. However, in revenge for Batman winning, the Joker turns.
Now wait a minute! You just told me it was the final confrontation. Well, how is the Joker?
It was the final. It was the final confrontation between Batman and the Joker, because the Joker, he was angry. You see that he lost to Batman in the final confrontation.
Okay. But let me ask you this: If So if that was the final confrontation and the Joker was still out there to take revenge, that means the Joker just got away and is still alive?
Actually, I found out what happened, Nick. I actually found the I looked through Wikipedia. I found the original like pitch for the television series. And apparently what happened is the Batmobile lost its wheel and the Joker got away in the end.
Oh.
And so the Joker is angry that Batman beat him, and so he turns his attention to those closest to the Dark Knight. And in this case, that would
be... Now, wait a minute. Okay, closest to the Dark Knight, and one of those people is Catwoman, even though we're told in the show that Batman and Catwoman had not had any contact for years.
Yes, because...
So essentially, the Joker was like, you know how I know how I'll get back at him? I'll go kill one of his random hookups from years ago.
He knew enough about him to know that she meant something to him. I mean, Vicky Vale apparently was impossible to get in contact with for anybody.
Yeah.
So
Alexander Knox was in hiding.
And so Catwoman was
useless. Commissioner Gordon wasn't there.
And so naturally, Selina
off camera, the Joker goes and injects Michael Goh with McGregor syndrome.
McGregor syndrome. Which turns you into an Irish MMA fighter. And then
Ian Abercrombie.
And Fitch. Don't even talk about Fitch. But the so anyway, he goes and he goes after Catwoman and he kills her. And then he goes and he shoots Barbara Gordon, aka Batgirl, right in the stomach and not kills her. Injures her, severs her spinal column, ruptures a disc which fragments into her spinal column.
And that's true. And Ace the Bat Hound is in the enclosed pool area.
And so... good Lord. My gosh. I got to tell this story, Nick. This has nothing to do with... We're on the second... We're getting near to the end here to the series, so I don't really give a shit if we go off topic. So I was sitting at lunch today with some coworkers, and one of my coworkers... We were talking, and I don't know how this came up, but we were talking about catchphrases or something, and I brought up Canyon's old catchphrase from WCW. I said it was a great gimmick where he'd say, you know, who's better than Canyon? And then the crowd would say everybody, and he'd get mad and say, no, not everybody, nobody. And then he, the one time on Thunder, he tricked them, and he said, who's not better than Canyon? And because wrestling fans are idiots, they all said everybody. And he said, ha, ha, I tricked you! And then he explained the joke to them, which made it even greater. And we all laughed, and then he goes, oh, yeah, Canyon was great. What an underrated talent. Whatever happened to him? And I said, I said, well, Matt, it's not good. And he said, I regret even asking, but I have to know. I was like, well, he killed himself. CTE, head trauma. And he was like, why is it that every time I ask you about what happened to some beloved wrestler from my youth, they either killed themselves or somebody else? I said, it's not for me to say, Matt. It's not for me to say. It ain't good is what I'm getting at. You know, I really like that I really like that Crippler guy. Whatever happened to him? Jimmy Snuka, the Superfly. What a guy. He could fly through the air with the greatest of ease. Whatever happened to that guy? He's still around, right? Anyway, so Birds of Prey, boy, it sucks. So there are some elements that are accurate to the comics. Barbara Gordon works out of her clock tower.
Now wait. We got to spend a little bit more time on this opening montage.
They're explaining all this stuff to us.
Yeah. So one, the CGI in this opening sequence has the Joker firing lightning bolts from this joy buzzer or whatever, and it looks. Man, it's something it's else.
It looked like he had Emperor Palpatine's lightning powers for a moment.
Yes. And also, how about this? They get a guy to play the Joker and put him in a bad, like, baggy-looking purple suit.
Dude, no. You undersold how bad the Joker looked. You undersold it. This is the worst Joker of all time. This is...
Worse than Jared Leto?
This is worse than Jared Leto. This is worse than that... Ooh. Remember that crappy cartoon, The Batman? That had the Joker that looked like Blanca from Street Fighter.
This is worse. The dreadlock Joker.
This is worse than that. This is the worst Joker. This looked like some dude. This I'm trying to even think of who what an example could be. This looks like Seth Green from 2001 went to a kid's Halloween party dressed as a clown and told everybody he was the Joker. That's what this looks like. It is the worst. His hair, Nick. My God.
Yes.
His hair is the worst thing. Oh my God. He looks atrocious and pathetic. There's no way you could ever take this Joker seriously at all. He's awful. He looks like it looks like somebody's doing a children's school play version of Stephen King's It. It's just atrociously bad.
And it's interesting because he doesn't just appear in the show. He also gets a couple of speaking lines, but instead of having whoever it is this guy is deliver the lines, they literally dub over his voice with Mark Hamill.
Yes, so they paid the money to have Mark Hamill record lines as the Joker for this show, but they did not pay the money to have Mark Hamill play the Joker in this show. Now, I started thinking about this, Nick, after we discussed this show briefly, and I tried to think, God, what could the reason for this be? Why on earth would they have just gotten him to do the voice? And I thought, well, maybe it was a situation where maybe he wasn't in shape for the role. And then I thought, no, that can't be it, because this guy looked like the least intimidating Joker of all time, so that can't be it. Maybe they thought that people would recognize Mark Hamill. Well, no, they could have put him under face paint and all that. They probably wouldn't have. It wouldn't have mattered. Or it might have even helped sell their show, for God's sake. And then I started thinking, maybe Mark Hamill was busy. And then I realized it was 2002. Mark Hamill wasn't busy doing anything. Mark Hamill was on a trampoline in 2002, waiting on George Lucas. And this is what they gave us. And here's the thing, Nick. That moment of him doing the Joker's voice might have been the best part of the episode. Because he shows up and they basically do the killing joke scene. And you're gone.
I'm here.
Well, you cut out for a second.
I'm here.
You cut out for a second.
It'll be okay. We're going to press on.
We're going to press on. But that might have been the best part of the whole episode was when he does the voiceover of the killing joke scene.
Yeah, the problem is they actually show the dude's mouth moving, and it looks so badly.
Oh, it's terrible.
It looks like a martial arts film.
It's atrocious. You know? It's atrocious. I mean, good Lord. This is all setting the stage.
And also then in the opening montage, yes. As Batwoman is being – or as Batgirl is being shot and Catwoman is being murdered, we then cut to an even younger, like 11 or 10-year-old version of Dinah Drake – waking up in her bed screaming because she's having nightmares, because in this interpretation of the Black Canary, she has no sonic scream. She's not really a hand-to-hand fighter. She just has slight telepathic abilities of some sort.
It's almost like, you know, it's so weird, Nick, because they explain her powers two different ways, right?
Right.
And later on in the episode, they say that when she touches people, she gets visions. So basically she has the Dead Zone power, right?
Yeah.
It's Anthony Michael Hall or Christopher Walken in the Dead Zone.
I prefer Christopher Walken.
They even do the – I like the show with Anthony Michael Hall. They do the grab of the hand and he does the face, which there's a great SNL sketch from like 1991 of Christopher Walken hosting SNL where he mocks the Dead Zone and does a bit where he has visions of the most boring aspect of that guy's person, of whoever it is, personality, the most boring thing in their lives. You're going to get groceries and you're only going to buy two bananas. Anyway, really good. And but then in this part of the episode, it appears that, like you said, that she has telepathy or she's maybe an empath, I guess you would say.
Yeah, something. Some sort of telepathy, some sort of mental ability.
She has visions of Batgirl getting shot and visions of the Huntress being widowed – or not widowed, orphaned. And so this leads her on a quest to go to New Gotham, which is the – as you might have sussed out, is the name of Gotham City now. And once there, she comes across the Birds of Prey when Huntress saves her from aforementioned Aaron Paul. And they take her in because of her unique abilities. She's determined to be a metahuman there's a cute little nod to Smallville here, where they're like, how did
meteorite showers. Well,
there's been some crazy stuff going on with meteorites lately. So kind of a ha-ha moment that could have led to something later on, thankfully didn't. And that's that. And we learn about metahumans, and there's a guy that's kind of loosely based on the Scarecrow, I guess, who is
ultra weird.
Yeah, it was like Dr. Destiny meets the Scarecrow, kind of.
And he was played by one of those guys, like one of those guys who, like, you see him, and it's like,
oh yes, and by the way, one of those guys that gives just an all-time bad performance.
Yes.
So bad. Like, that scene...
I believe, and this is a random pull, Greg, but I believe he also played the orphanage director in The Dark Knight Rises, who was telling John Blake about why this kid had disappeared or whatever.
Between him and Turn Himself In guy, how do some of the worst actors get jobs in Christopher Nolan movies?
I don't know.
As bit players. I could have been in a Christopher Nolan movie at this point. I haven't been. But I'd happily.
You know what's shocking? This show has a 6.4 on IMDb.
I thought you were talking about our rating.
No.
Oh.
Birds of Prey has a 6.4 on IMDb and a 52% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow. But maybe we're the ones that are not giving it enough credit.
I guess.
Nonetheless, that notwithstanding, it's it's such a weird take on these characters. Their personality, the weird thing though, Nick, the one thing that I will say, and as we get into the fixing it and nixing it part here, the weird aspect of this is the personalities of the characters are not that far off, except for Dinah. Dinah's way off.
There's nothing Dinah like her.
Nothing like any version of Black Canary that I've ever encountered. Huntress is pretty spot on. Barbara is perfect, honestly. I will actually make the controversial statement. That this is probably the best version of Barbara Gordon that we've gotten on the big screen.
The best version of like this interpretation of Barbara Gordon's life. Like, we've never really seen this explored before, so she's by default the best, but also she is easily of the three the closest to her comic book counterpart.
Yes, I agree. And she's right off the page, to be honest with you. She looks like Barbara. She talks like Barbara. Oracle is I've always said this about Barbara Gordon anyway, that Oracle is far more interesting than Batgirl, because she's different. She's unique. She's her own person. There's nobody in comics like Oracle, or at least there wasn't when she was first there. She kind of set the template for other characters that came later, but she stands apart. As Oracle, as Batgirl, she's just another person in a bat costume that has a unique personality, you know. But granted, but as Oracle, she's so unique and serves an audience that's underserved by comics. Anyway, she's an amazing character, and I didn't think Alicia Silverstone was a very good interpretation of Barbara Gordon in Batman and Robin, not through her fault necessarily. You know, in the, of course, the 60s series, she's just kind of she's there, but she's not much of a character per se. And then,
right.
And honestly, even in the animated series, I never thought Batgirl was a terribly great character in the animated series. She's kind of, damsel in distressy at times. And then of course we won't get into what happened with her in the Killing Joke movie. To me, this might be my favorite screen version of Barbara Gordon that we've had to this point. Having not seen some things like the Harley Quinn show and stuff like that where she might appear. But yeah, I really like this performance from I have to find this actress's name again. Dinah Meyer.
Okay, here we go. I've gotten the answer to the Black Canary thing, the three names thing. So she starts the show proclaiming to be Dinah Drake. And then it is revealed that she is lying about her last name because she is ashamed of her foster parents, the Redmonds, who taught her to hide her metahuman abilities and that it was something to be ashamed of. So she has a conflicted past with them. And so she reveals that her name is actually Dinah Redmond. But then it is revealed ultimately in the show that she is actually the daughter of the original Black Canary who gave her up for adoption whenever she did not have metahuman abilities because she felt like she couldn't take care of herself. The original Black Canary in this show, by the way, is played by convicted felon Lori Loughlin.
Oh, wow. Aunt Becky.
Yes.
Wow. I might have to examine some of these episodes later, Nick. That's an interesting turn of events. Quite frankly, what a convoluted story, though. My God.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's dispense of the pleasantries about this damn show and talk about the fixing it or nixing it. I mean, as we often do with these things, I think the least of the issues, and I feel like I say this almost every time we do one of these, with some exceptions, but the least of the issues is the cast to me. I don't think any of these actresses are bad. Ashley Scott does a good job of playing Huntress. I thought she was compelling, and she comes off as a badass. Dinah Meyer is great as Barbara, and for this version of Dinah, don't call me Chris Redman, Rachel Skarsten does a good job of playing the character that she's asked to play. This kind of innocent, naive girl that's new to Gotham. She does a good job of playing that. Not bad at all. Shamar Moore is fine as detective, whatever. And then, and Mia Sara is good as this version of as Harleen Quinzel. She's not a good Harley Quinn because we don't really get to see her be Harley Quinn, but she's good as the psychiatrist who's clearly trying to get information or at least I thought she was trying to get information out of Huntress, but then at the end of the episode, they kind of circumvent that by indicating that she has no idea who this is that's fighting criminals in Gotham. So I don't know. But would you agree with that mostly, Nick?
Yeah, the actresses are mostly fine. If you're going to go with these versions of the characters, that's what it comes back to is like one of the things we struggle with on the fix it or nix it deal is like, how far can you go in the fixing of it? Because if I'm trying to fix this, the concept of the show is something I would probably have to fix. Because like this young, naive, non-Black Canary doesn't really work for me. This whole like backstory about the crazy backstory of Batman and the Joker and Batman being gone and the Joker like killing people and shooting like the whole deal. I don't know, man.
Is there even a real need to tie it that heavily into Batman? Obviously, you're in Batman's world, but is there even really that much of a need to relate that everything that's happening is because of Batman?
I don't know. I don't know. I just – I'm very – this whole thing, I don't know that if you're working from this foundation – I don't know that it can be fixed for me anyway.
I think if these are your three character templates, you can keep Batgirl and you can keep Huntress the same. I have an issue. First of all, I don't think you should try to tie it into the movie universe, first of all, which is hurt anyway by the fact that the Joker even exists, by the way. He clearly dies at the end of the first Batman movie, but nonetheless, I think it's a mistake, a flawed foundation to try to tie it into the Batman movies. They were shot at that point. They were dead in the water and they weren't coming back. And so, there was no real point to it. I think that, the only aspect of Huntress that really bothered me was giving her the cat powers. It was so unnecessary. But as a template character, you can work with that. And you can still even have her be Helena Kyle. And you can still have her be the daughter of Batman and Catwoman if you want to. I think you can still work with that foundation. But one of the defining traits of the Huntress in the comics is this quest for vengeance of some kind. Whether it's Helena Bertinelli.
Right. This version of the character in the pilot is like almost doesn't even really want to be doing doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
it's like she's being forced to by
she's
Barbara.
She's more doing it out of obligation to Barbara, who's this kind of mother figure in her life. That's kind of her. But I think you can keep the actresses the same and the template of this bitter, angry character. But I think there has to be some sort of end goal for Huntress. There has to be something that's driving her and motivating her. And maybe by the end, maybe your season arc is she comes to terms with the fact that vengeance is not going to make her family come back, that vengeance is not going to make her feel any better. And then she becomes just she does it out of justice and duty. That was a story they told with Helena in the comics over the course of years. Barbara, can, to me, can be exactly what she is. That's perfectly fine. The real problem, Nick, and I don't know that there's any way to get around this without scrapping the show and rebuilding it, is that is just not Black Canary at all.
Right.
Maybe you make her a new character, an original character. I don't know. But there's just no way that
How about this? If you want to use a young character, a young somewhat naive character with a tie to the comics, why not just make her Stephanie Brown?
Yeah, Stephanie Brown or even Cassandra Cain. You know, whatever you want to do with her in that regard, Stephanie would make more sense probably. But yeah, just do a different version of the Birds of Prey. Do a different, you know, makeup.
Yeah.
If you're hell bent on doing this young naive character new to Gotham. You don't need metahuman powers in the show because, first of all, it's abundantly clear the show did not have the budget to do metahuman powers. They had the budget, by the way, to license songs from Avril Lavigne and Oasis, but they didn't have the budget to have decent special effects.
Right.
So I would have avoided the metahuman powers entirely. I guess the shitty villain can stay the same. I don't know. This is a nix-it, quite frankly, because it's just so hard to work around the flawed foundation. I think as a challenge, yes, you can keep these three actresses, you can keep these three character templates, but you're never going to win over anybody that is familiar with the Birds of Prey on this because it's so far removed from what Black Canary is. And you're going to have a hard time gripping a new audience, in my opinion, because it's so wrapped up in its own mythology. This first episode is confusing. Like, there's so much going on. There are so many moving, twisting machinations that the Joker's doing this and Batman's doing that and Helena's doing this, but really she's doing it because of that. And Harleen Quinzel is doing this, but secretly she's doing that. And Barbara is this, but she used to be that, but she's still haunted by that and wants to be that, but she's this. And she's also still trapped in the world of Batman and all that stuff. And then Dinah's got different names.
Also, we didn't call this out. Tech wizard Barbara Gordon is still reliant on a beeper in 2002.
Yes. This show, though, does deserve some credit for an innovation. This may have been the first superhero show that created the person sitting at the desk talking to the hero through an earpiece and the hero talking back to them, which of course was a staple of the Arrowverse and has been for many years.
Yeah.
So this may have been the first, cause I don't recall seeing it in any of the shows before that. But yeah, maybe the show got better, Nick. I don't know. Maybe as the show went on, it found its footing. There's a Lady Shiva episode I'm looking through here. There's a Clayface episode, which has to be bad.
God.
There's that's interesting. Gladiatrix. I don't know, man. I just have a hard time imagining that this show could have worked from this foundation. And things to fix, like I said, like you said, change the Dinah character or rename her, make her something else, a new character for the show, or bring in a character like Stephanie Brown, and then give us something in the realm of a hook for the show and the villain that's stronger than what we get here. There are some good things here. There's some good lines of dialogue here. Some of the sassy dialogue from Huntress is good. Barbara's good. There's just a lot of bad here. A lot of dated stuff too. You know, it's really of its era. Some of the you talked earlier today, Nick, about the weird transitions and cuts in this episode. It seemed to be, I don't know, some form of computer graphics. I couldn't tell.
I believe they pulled up they used a PlayStation 2 from that time to build these.
Yes, PlayStation 2 era graphics. And yeah, Not unlike, they really, it does actually look a little bit like the old Spider-Man 2 game, but yeah, not good. And while there are some good things here, performances in particular, some of them were good. And the you know, the character dynamics are not bad, with, like, you know, Dinah's kind of trying to push her way into this group. They're unsure about it. Huntress doesn't want her there at first, but kind of grows to respect her a little bit as the episode progresses. So there's some good basic storytelling there, but as a comic book adaptation, it's awfully flawed.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It just feels like so flawed, and just from the very beginning, and yeah, you got to take a hard pass on this one.
Absolutely, and you know, maybe there's some other stuff, some more creative people than us that could take the time to figure out ways to fix what's already there, the bare bones of it. We'd love to hear your ideas. Let us know on Twitter at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. And again, I do want to mention, I genuinely did like the performances in this, and thought there were some good aspects of this show. It's just the overall approach to adapting the comic is so strange, and it really also speaks to a time, and this is something also I wanted to mention, Nick, because it's interesting, because this was a time when, let's face it, they were, by they I mean Hollywood studios, television, movies, etc., they were terrified of directly adapting comics, right? They didn't want costumes that looked like they were from the comics,
right?
No tights, no flights, all that stuff. The X-Men movies with the leather jackets and all that, they did not want to look like a comic book. They thought that would be a bad thing. And yet, I was going to say this is of its time in that regard, that they run so far from the comics, and yet they embrace aspects of the comics that I was shocked that they did. Barbara Gordon is Oracle. The Killing Joke is directly referenced. The Joker in his ridiculous costume on there. The cat eyes, telepathy and stuff like that. It's so weird, Nick, because it's almost trapped between two worlds, trapped between the we're ashamed of our source material and we're embracing it in a way that most people around us are not. And also probably served as the lesson 1A of why you shouldn't try to adapt comics at this time, because, gosh, look what it will become if you try to look like a comic book. So I don't know, man. Does it feel that way to you? Like it's almost in two worlds?
Totally, which is, yeah, you know, possibly part of my deal with why, you know, I've never been able to get past the early episodes of Smallville, because there's a little bit of that same feeling with that. But at least with Smallville, it's relatively well done. You know, the concept is executed to a certain degree, whereas here, not so much.
I'm trying to remember, Nick, what was the name of that damn Avril Lavigne song that was in this episode? It's driving me crazy. I can't remember the
title. I have no idea. I don't know.
Oh, don't act like you weren't a big Avril Lavigne fan. Everyone was.
I was. Never mind.
You were a skater boy at one time.
No, I was not.
She said, "See you later, boy."
No, she did not.
I'm going to find out the name of this song right now. It's going to be great audio. Everybody's listening to. It wasn't "Why the Hell'd You Go and Make Things So Complicated." It wasn't that one. I know that. Well, I don't think there's any way of me ever knowing this answer unless I go to Avril Lavigne's discography and find out her singles. Complicated, Skater Boy, I'm With You. I remember that song. Anyway, it's none of those songs. I don't know what the hell the song was. Oh, well, screw it. There's an Oasis song as well, and it's good. Well, that's it. We're going to take a break, and we come back on the other side. We're going to have Read and Watching, and we're going to have the rundown. And, Nick, there's one thing I wanted to tell you before we go to break.
What's that?
You don't belong here. You don't have any legs.
Good God.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop Feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the flip side of the show here. And it's about that time, Nick, to talk about the PN news and notes in the world of comic books, comic book associated media. It's a segment known Across This Great Divide as The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to The Rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Well, not a lot of stuff going on right now, Nick, in our world, but some. And so we're going to discuss that right now. And we're going to start with big news coming out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Unexpected news, I would think it fair to classify it as, Nick. And that is that Sam Raimi, the helmer of the best Spider-Man movie of all time, in my opinion, and another Spider-Man movie as well, and another one besides that, a legend in the world of comic book film directing, is in talks to direct Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness for Marvel Studios. It's according to Variety. He would replace Scott Derrickson, who departed the project due to creative differences. Wow, Nick, this is a bombshell, is it not? I did not see this coming at all.
Yeah, because the thought process was that Scott Derrickson was walking away because of, you know, not being allowed to exercise his own creative vision over the film, you know, creative control or whatever. And Sam Raimi is one of those guys who kind of has generally, marched to the beat of his own drum. And, you know, the last time that he was involved in a situation where he wasn't allowed to do that, most notably, was probably Spider-Man 3. And so it seems interesting that he would consider jumping into the Marvel Cinematic Universe with its parameters and having to work within that structure. But if you think about it, the concept of Multiverse of Madness, as it's been explained, as more of a horror tinge look at the MCU and dealing with these alternate realities and stuff, that kind of seems like a perfect fit
right
for someone like Sam Raimi. So I hope this happens.
Yeah, I agree. I think this sounds like an ideal fit for Sam Raimi going into the MCU. If you're going to put him in any situation, this is the one. And, you know, it remains to be seen if this project still happens. Maybe he signs on, and then he has creative differences. As we know, Sam Raimi has a very distinctive style to his movies.
Right.
Is Marvel going to be happy with that? I don't know. They should know what they're getting into. He's a well-respected director that has countless movies under his belt. So they should be able to know what they're getting and let him do his thing. And I think if they do, this could be one of the most interesting MCU entries to date.
Absolutely. It's just a matter of, you know, allowing him to have that creative control, which, you know, for better or for worse, they allowed Taika Waititi some level of that control. Mm-hmm. So maybe Sam Raimi will get that as well.
Will it be anything like Vince Russo's creative control faction in 1999?
No, but it will be like Sports Entertainment Extreme.
SEX, which had, of course, the legendary pairing of the Johnsons, Richard and Rod mm-hmm. Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Dick and Rod Johnson, yep.
Awesome. Richard out there on the internet. Owen Wilson, remember him, Nick? Remember when he was a superstar?
I do. Yes, go ahead. I know you are having to exercise every ounce of self-control right now.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Go ahead. Go ahead. What? It's not among your better efforts. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead. What? What are you talking about?
He has been regaling me during the break with his Owen Wilson impression, which sounds kind of like Igor in any live action interpretation of Frankenstein that you've seen.
Wow. I don't understand what you're talking about, man. Like, wow.
Good Lord. You usually have such good impressions, and that one is a particularly awful one.
Owen Wilson has been cast for an undisclosed role for...
You sound like Adam Sandler and Little Nicky.
Owen Wilson has been cast in an undisclosed role for Disney Plus Loki.
Ooh, Little Nicky. I hate that movie, by the way. Not good.
It's not a movie. No, it's not.
According to comic book, the report indicates that the comedy actor has a major part in Disney Plus's Loki. Well, you're Mr. Loki and Thor over here, Nick. Who you think Owen Wilson's going to play?
Well, based on the footage that we'll talk about here in just a second, I'm assuming somebody involved with the Time Variance Authority, which is a group of individuals that I didn't even know existed in the Marvel Universe, never encountered them. So that's my guess. Anyway, maybe the head of this Time Authority. Ava Sharp, yeah. Yeah, that's it.
A little footnote in history. This is an interesting part of this article. Owen Wilson was rumored to play Cyclops in 2000's X-Men movie, but was beaten out by James Marsden. I never knew that.
I don't remember that either.
I never knew.
And besides, he would have had the problem of like blowing off the tip of his nose every time he used the glass.
Oh, we are terrible. All right. Yeah, so we also – the Super Bowl happened a few days ago. Some people may know that. It was a football game that took place. It was watched by a bunch of people, and there were commercials that happened. One of those commercials that happened featured Sam Elliott's mustache dancing. How great was that? And
that was good.
And one of them had Groundhog Day in it with Bill Murray. That was good. Mm-hmm. And one of them told us that we're all going to lose our loved ones and then forget they even existed. So that was great. And then yet another one happened that showed us footage from all of the MCU shows that are coming to Disney Plus. Let's talk about them. So, new Falcon and Winter Soldier and WandaVision both have new synopses, neither of which reveals too much information about them. The most interesting of which is finding out that WandaVision blends the style of classic sitcoms with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, featuring Wanda and Vision, two superpowered beings living their ideal suburban lives, but they begin to suspect that everything is not as it seems. And this is going to be start as a very funny, entertaining show, and it's going to end up incredibly sad, Nick, because it feels like it's borrowing elements from For the Man Who Has Everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... a comic book and a trope that will always make me sad and emotional.
And it was interesting because the trailer, the little clip we saw during the Super Bowl, the Super Bowl commercial, it looked like it was going to – maybe each episode is kind of going to take off after a different sitcom. Like it looked like there was one that was clearly modeled after I Love Lucy. It looked like there was one kind of modeled after maybe the Brady Bunch. Then it looked like there was one that was kind of modeled after like Roseanne or something. And so it looked like maybe a different sitcom from every era is going to be referenced in this visual.
I think they should do one that's based on Seinfeld and one that's based on The Office.
Oh, of course they will. And of course they'll be the two greatest episodes of the show.
No doubt. But no, I thought it was really compelling. I thought this was I thought WandaVision was the most interesting of the three shows as far as like looking at them. It just looks totally different. Looks awesome. It looks like it's going to be crazy in all the best ways. I'm just expecting to be emotionally gut punched by this because I always am by this style of show. Of course, the classic, my favorite Batman episode, Perchance to Dream, is a similar concept. He gets everything that he ever wanted and he has to give it up. And it's gonna be rough to watch. Now, do you think there's a chance that WandaVision leads to mutants?
Possibly. I would place more money on her appearance in Multiverse of Madness leading to mutants, since we know that she is appearing in that film as well.
I just want to see. I know it probably won't happen, but I literally want her to just say, mutants. they all appear. Anyway, that won't happen. Also, Captain America and Winter, or the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, looks amazing. And
yes.
The first thing you see is Falcon pulling the shield up and throwing it into a tree, like as practice. It just, I can't wait. It's going to be great. Zemo is back, being confronted by Winter Soldier. Just what's not to love?
Yeah, it looks awesome.
Looks high end. And then Loki, we didn't see as much of. So hard to tell.
No,
much
they
about that.
They were, you know, like one clip of him sitting in some sort of cell in like a prison uniform. And that was pretty much it. But all the footage, I mean, it looks cinema quality, which is what we were promised and what we got with The Mandalorian. And seems like that's going to extend into the Marvel shows as well.
Well, let's move, if we can, Nick, from Marvel shows over to DC shows, and particularly the Arrowverse, which, of course, we just wrapped up the forefather of the Arrowverse. And now we're getting ready to add the newest series into the Arrowverse, and it is the CW's Superman and Lois. And apparently that show has now cast its two super sons. We found out, of course, at the end of Crisis on Infinite Earth that in the new Earth Prime, Superman and Lois now have two children. And the casting has been Alexander Garfin and Jordan Elsass have been cast as the sons of Clark Kent and Lois Lane. Elsass will play Jonathan Kent, described as a clean-cut, modest, and kind-hearted kid with an aw-shucks attitude that somehow doesn't seem dated. And then Garfin's Jordan Kent is described as wildly intelligent, but his mercurial temperament and social anxiety limits his interactions with people, and consequently spends most of his free time alone playing video games. So essentially, Nick, one of these characters is Greg Phillips, and one of these characters is Nick Duke.
Oh, listen to you. Listen to you talking about how much, you know, your old-fashioned attitudes and trying to pretend that disdain for people doesn't apply to you as well.
Oh, I love all people, Nick, just as I always have.
Yes, sure you do.
You
love persons. You hate people.
I love persons. I used to love more people until I met you, and you showed me the ills of the world.
The error of your ways, yep.
There is speculation that Jordan could be a version of the comic book character Damian Wayne, perhaps entrusted to Clark and Lois's care while his father, Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. Batman, is missing. What do you think of that possibility, Nick? That'd be pretty neat, wouldn't it?
That would be pretty awesome. I would be all for it. You know, the Damian Wayne, Jonathan Kent, which it sounds like we're going to get something approaching that dynamic anyway, right. Even if it's not technically Damian. But I'm all for it because if you're going to have all the shows on one Earth anyway, why not embrace that and have the story of Bruce's disappearance playing out across multiple shows?
Yeah. Where'd he go? Why'd he go? And now he's left his boy in the care of his best friend.
Plus, I know for you, you'd have to appreciate the idea that there's nobody he'd trust more with his son.
Oh, absolutely. The Bruce and Clark friendship is essential. And I think that's a great thing. And so I hope that happens. I'll be so first day. I hope that happens. I'm not going to dock the show points if that's not the case, but I hope it happens. I think it's a makings for an interesting show. And, you know, we were speculating last week, Nick, how do you differentiate a Superman show from a Supergirl show? And I think this is a good first step in that, pretty much telling us that it could be a Super Son show in a way.
Yes, that's a great way to go. And Greg Phillips is dying. Greg? Okay, I'm supposed to talk now because Greg's dying. So, Superman and Lois, we're looking forward to it. One other thing that we're looking forward to, but not really because we don't read comics anymore, is DC's free comic book day offering, which this year is going to be, you know, for the last several years, DC has kind of largely done reprints for Free Comic Book Day. But now, this year, they're going to go back to an original offering a one-shot called Generation Zero that is going to tie into the newly revised DC timeline and set the stage for the future of the DC universe. It's supposed to serve as something of a epilogue to the current flash-forward limited series starring Wally West. And apparently, judging by this cover and other things that DC's put out, this free comic book day issue is going to see Wally West taking on the powers of Dr. Manhattan. Yes, he will become the new steward of the Mobius chair, and he will be imbued with the infinite power of Dr. Manhattan himself.
Unlimited power!
Hey, Greg's still alive. Apparently, he's going to be using this power to rewrite reality to a certain extent in an effort to bring his family back, which we know has been his driving goal since the events of Rebirth, really. So, I'm not reading comics right now anyway, so what do I care? Why should I complain about anything? I'm sure this will have cool moments, and I'm not a huge Wally guy, but doesn't this seem a bit out of character for even Wally?
You know, it does. First of all, would you classify his power as unlimited or incredible power?
I'm going to go with unlimited.
All right, very good. Secondly, yeah, we were kind of talking during the break. It feels a little parallaxy, doesn't it?
A little bit.
Motivated by his own personal loss to try to quote-unquote fix things and set things right. And while, don't get me wrong, I hope he succeeds. I hope that as a result of this, that Wally's children come back, that Wally becomes one of the Flashes again. I hope that all of that, everything is set right. And I'm all for DC streamlining their continuity. Thought Doomsday Clock was amazing in that regard. But I'll be honest, there is an element of me that fears that they're going to take that nice setup and screw it up.
Well, I mean, you are familiar with the rumored 5G initiative, right?
Yeah, but there's no details of it, are there?
In terms of what?
In terms of what the reboot is going to do, what it's going to be, like what the major changes are. I know that they're going to have replacement heroes, but that's
yes,
the that doesn't matter.
The like, idea is that it would introduce an entirely new generation of heroes.
Yeah, a new generation of Batman. Heroes is fine. I'm more concerned about changing the past of the DCU.
John Kent. Yeah, apparently the idea, if you believe Bleeding Cool anyway, is that they're going to attempt something of a, God help us, Grant Morrison-style approach where they're going to try and fit every era of the DC universe into one timeline. So you will have Wonder Woman, her first appearances and her Golden Age stuff is the foundational canonical first appearance of heroes in the DC universe. Then you'll have the Golden Age of heroes. Then you'll have, you know, and the idea is to try and fit it all into one timeline.
Right. I don't hate that. I think it can be done. I think that's not a bad approach. It's not too different from what they did with post-crisis back in the day. And perhaps they can do it better this time. You know, I don't know. I'm willing to give them the chance to do it. I'm just saying, like, DC's burned me so many times on this stuff with, like, changing shit for no reason that, you know, I still am of the opinion that they could just bring back and they have brought back a lot of the elements of pre-Flashpoint. I kind of feel like almost all of it should be brought back at this point and kind of folded into whatever they do moving forward. If they want a new generation of heroes, I have no problem with that. You know, I've felt that for whatever reason, every generation of fan holds on to their versions of the characters, their generation, in other words. So my generation of readers, Wally was the Flash, Kyle Rayner was Green Lantern, and I'm the outlier on that. I never had any attachment to him. But they want those guys. Kyle is Green Lantern, and Connor Hawke is Green Arrow, for God's sake. That's what they want. But it's time to move on. There's a new era now. I'm fine with there being a new generation of characters for a new generation of readers to be these new legacy characters. That's fine. But let's not forget the past. Let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater, which is what DC did in 2011, and they've been trying to recover from it ever since. In my estimation, Nick, I don't know if you would agree with that.
To a certain extent, my thing with the new generation of legacy characters is I understand that part of DC's concept is legacy characters, and that's great, mm-hmm. and I think they should do more to embrace that. The problem is they mismanage the legacy characters they have now.
True.
So, like, if you bring in a whole new generation to fill on these legacy roles, what does that mean for the pre-existing legacy characters? Does that mean even less room for someone like a Tim Drake or a Connor Kent or a Dick Grayson or whoever? Does that mean even less notoriety for them? Because really, fans are always going to want the classic characters of Bruce and Clark and Diana and Hal and that era. And if you're throwing them focus and also throwing these new characters focus, what happens to the Dick Graysons of the world? What happens to the, you know, to those characters?
Jessica Cruz is a character that, if the rumors are true about a new prominent Green Lantern coming up, I could easily see Jessica, unfortunately, getting thrown to the wolves along with Guy Gardner and John Stewart and a lot of other characters. We'll have to see how that all comes about. But I do think that it's fine to have a new generation of heroes. Because, you know, people from the old generation complained back in the 90s about what was happening to some of their favorite characters. Hal, Barry, you know, Barry less so probably, but Hal certainly, the fans complained about the changes to him. Dick Grayson was something of a weird character for a while there in the early 90s, pushed to the side in the Batman books and all that stuff. So it happens seemingly every generation, but it's unique to see. Regardless, I'm happy Wally West is playing a prominent role. I just hope it doesn't result in him evaporating or turning into a bad guy, which feels like it could easily happen here.
It does feel that way.
And I guess that's it, Nick. I think that's the end of our jaunt into the world of news and notes in the comics world. Will there be one next week? Well, you all just have to listen and find out whether there is or isn't. But for now, it's time to move on and talk about what we've been reading and watching in the world of comics. A segment that we've been doing since the very beginning of our show, way back when. It's called Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching? So, Nick, have you been reading anything? I have not.
I have not either.
Have you been watching anything?
Yeah, CW stories are back.
Yes, I have. Now, here's the thing. I've watched this week's Legends and Flash, but we're not ready to talk about those yet. We'll talk about those next week. I am not watching right now Batwoman, Black Lightning, and Supergirl. I have to wait till the end of the season to watch them on Netflix because of the way this stupid CW app does, offloading the first episodes of the season, which you would think would happen. They time out or whatever. Instead, they'll keep the first episode of the season and they'll offload like the next three. So there's really, it's
no. So there's nothing for you to talk about then, because we've already talked about Legends for a couple weeks ago.
So it's all you, you take over.
Yeah. So Batwoman, first up, follows up the twist ending from the previous episode in pretty satisfactory fashion, and kind of gives you an idea of what might have been in Kate's life, and kind of plays into some crisis stuff in a unique way. I don't want to say too much because I know you're going to watch it at some point. Good episode, I thought. One of the stronger episodes of the series to date, really, in my opinion anyway. And digs more into the Alice backstory. And whenever they've done that, and giving you an idea of what exactly she went through, it's been really well done for the most part, and been one of the more fascinating things on the show. Supergirl, meanwhile, it was good to see Wynn back. Wynn coming back on the most recent episode that we talked about, playing Wynn shot that we know and love, but also it's clear that the way he's being portrayed is that there have been some events that have happened to him in his life, and he isn't quite as quirky and quite as lighthearted as he used to be. So it's like, it's both the character that we know and love, but also not that character. It's interesting the way they've done it. And they give us a doppelganger win as well from a holdover from a forgotten Earth where he actually became the new Toy Man. So you get to see the same actor playing two different versions of Win, and it's pretty cool and well done in that episode as well.
Can I make an embarrassing admission, Nick?
What's that?
All the way back in the first season, I shipped Wynn and Kara from the very beginning.
Oh my god! Wow,
I did.
Yeah. Well, I guess part of that could have been the fact that we were so disgusted by James Olsen from the jump that we were pulling for pretty much anybody else. But yeah. I will say that this new teased romance of her and William Day is almost if not worse than the James Olsen romance in my estimation. But that's neither here nor there. And then Black Lightning, I'm trying to remember exactly what happened on Black Lightning. Yes. The character of Lynn, Black Lightning's wife, has become even more of a raging bitch because she's now a drug addict, and I want Black Lightning to put her in her place. And that's all I have to say about that.
Put her in her place? What do you mean by that? Shoot her with lightning?
Shoot her with lightning, you know, give her a stern talking to, stop taking her constantly calling him out for no reason and down and putting him down.
You know, Lynn is a character that really went up and down with me because the first season I found her largely unbearable for most of the season. Just constantly nagging Jefferson and making his life miserable and blaming everything on him. Then she kind of started to turn it around at the end of that season, you know, and I was like, okay, she's being more reasonable now. So I was like, okay, I can get behind Lynn a little bit, but now it's kind of like, you know, at this point from what you're saying, and I noticed a little bit at the beginning of the second season when unfortunately I stopped watching the show, not intentionally, but I'm going to catch back up at some point. I'll have some time in the near future, as I understand it. But, yeah, so I'm looking forward to catching up on all of these shows, Black Lightning at the forefront. So, with all that being said, I'm trying to think if I've watched anything comic book related. Oh, playing! Gosh, Nick, I can't believe I was almost going to go the whole site without talking about this. I have finished The Arkham Knight. Can you believe it, Nick? I in the course of, what, a little over a week, it took me to beat Arkham Knight, all of the downloaded content, except for the Catwoman side mission, which I have not beaten because it's incredibly hard. I've done everything you can do in the game except collect all the Riddler trophies, which I will not do. And I finished it, man. So take over. Ask me whatever you want to ask me about Arkham Knight. I'm ready.
Wasn't it good?
Yes. Yes, it was good. It was very good. It was very, very good. And I even know who the Arkham Knight is.
Oh, Truman Capote?
Yes! The shocking moment happens. He takes it off and he says, in cold blood. And it's actually Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Truman Capote. But no, really great game, as all these Arkham games are. The voice acting, incredible.
Yes, that's the big one. I need you to finally acknowledge you were vocally and vehemently against the idea, yes, of Mark Hamill's Joker even being, yes, included in the game in any way, shape,
yes,
form, or fashion. And I kept telling you, well, wait till you play it. It's a little different. They did it in a little different fashion. I think you'll be okay with it. And?
And it was the best part of the game. And I say this, it's funny, Nick. It's one of those things where I feel like we say it every time. Like, every time that we watch an Okada match, we're like, oh gosh, that guy's next level. Every time I play an Arkham game, I say, that was probably Mark Hamill's finest Joker performance to date. And then I see another Mark Hamill Joker performance, and I say, that's his best Joker performance to date. Well, Nick, I'm prepared to say it. Arkham Knight is Mark Hamill's best Joker performance to date. Even over... Now, this is recency bias.
I agree.
This is recency bias, though, because he was amazing in Arkham City. And I do remember it's been many years since I played Arkham City. Probably 5 or more years since I played Arkham City. But I remember he was amazing in Arkham City. But boy, is he fantastic in this game. Just needling Bruce throughout the game from inside his consciousness. So many great lines, the rage in his voice at times, and then all the way, he's in control for so much of this game. He's got the leverage for the entire game, as he has really for the entire series. And then the fear that sets in at the very end, Nick, for the very first time, the Joker being afraid.
Yes.
It's amazing. No knock on Kevin Conroy, who's very good in this game. Mark Hamill steals this game from a performance standpoint.
Yeah, and that he's given some great material here, whether it's flashbacks to his interactions with the Bat family over the years, where we get more fleshed out.
I mean, is it I'll just go ahead and say it. Spoiler warning, if you're going to – if you haven't played Arkham Knight, play it. I genuinely don't want to spoil it if you have no idea what the story is. So stop listening to the podcast right now if you haven't played Arkham Knight. That being said, spoiler alert, the Jason stuff.
Outstanding.
Amazing. The stuff with Jason and the Joker in particular, the flashbacks showing this version of under the Red Hood story, essentially. The story of death in the family slash under the Red Hood. Really great. Really, really great, this version of it. And let's face it, it owes a lot to Batman Beyond Return of the Joker.
Yes.
And I think that's clear. It wears its influences on its sleeve in that regard. And it's an amazing telling of this story. If I had one complaint about the story of the game, Nick, the only thing that ultimately bothered me, really, about the story, there were some little things here and there where I think that it separated a little bit, not being quite as good as Arkham City. But the one thing that stood out as bothering me was they really rushed the conclusion of the Jason arc in this game. I was, after all that buildup, I needed a little bit more than one scene of Bruce talking to him and suddenly he realizes the error of his ways. Especially when you had so much real estate during the course of the game to play with. Maybe take out that Cobra tank battle and give us some more Bruce and Jason talking to each other.
I've pretty much said I think it's probably my favorite video game of all time, just because of the Arkham series. To me, much like the Chris Nolan series, you give me legitimately great masterpiece level Batman stuff, and I'm probably gonna like it better than just about damn near anything. And I think where we differ is I actually enjoyed the Batmobile for the most part, and I think you were frustrated by it.
Yeah,
more than
I did not
else.
Like. I mean, I will say this: the tank mode version portions of the Batmobile were okay. I actually ended up enjoying those at times because it wasn't that difficult, really. But the Cobra tank battle level was legit one of the most frustrating things I've tried to do on a video game in a long, long, long time. I mean, it was up there with like trying to catch the legendary bass on Red Dead Redemption 2, which is damn near impossible, as it turns out. It was so frustrating that it almost made me quit the game at one point. And I'm glad I didn't. I kept going. But that level was insanely hard, in my opinion. But the rest of the tank stuff was fine in the game. What I really hated was just the driving mechanics. If the Batmobile drove that badly, Batman would never catch anyone. First of all, he'd be paying all of his millions of dollars in property damage. Second of all, apparently the Batmobile hasn't had the tires rotated and balanced in 20 years. It's just not a good drive. And so that's really what killed me. And then the Riddler races. Oh my God, Nick. Oh my God. I yelled some words that I didn't even know I knew. Playing this game at times due to the Batmobile. So yes, that the Batmobile and the rushing of the Jason story keeps this firmly behind Arkham City for me in the series. I still think Arkham City is the standard bearer, but Arkham Knight was amazing. And Arkham Knight introduced so many cool innovations in the series that took it to the next level. Some of the gameplay additions that they added in, some of the challenges to the gameplay, adding in villains that can scramble your detective mode, adding in villains that can sense you when you're using detective mode and use it to hone in on your location. That made it a little more challenging. Certainly some of the combat stuff was more challenging. The shot gloves, I'm getting a lot of feedback here, Nick.
Oh, sorry. I don't know. Am I doing something wrong?
I don't know. It was like I was hearing myself coming in through your.
Oh, weird.
Your side. But anyway, the innovations and gameplay were incredible. Just getting to play as the Batmobile is a big deal. I got to give him credit for even trying it. It's something nobody had really tried since, God, the Super Nintendo with Batman Returns. So,
Batman Vengeance, if you remember game, it had some Batmobile levels.
I didn't
levels.
Remember that having them.
But they were all. But it was always with everything before. It was always leveled, right? Like you would do an entire level. This is the Batmobile in an open world, which is never been done before.
And the other minor thing that I think made me enjoy Arkham City more, and I don't know if this is even true, I have to go back and play Arkham City. Arkham City felt a little more lived in, I guess. There were more places to visit and people to talk to in Arkham City, it felt like, than there are in Knight.
Oh, man. See, I felt the opposite. Like, Knight is so much
bigger
and more expansive and got more to do in it that, like, I felt the opposite.
I just don't remember beating City as quickly as I beat Arkham Knight. Maybe I did. I can't recall. It's been so long. I was also disappointed that once you get through the big Nightfall protocol at the end, I remember in Arkham City, one of the fun things was to go and visit people around the map and see how they reacted to all this. And here, there's really no one to visit. You can go to Gotham PD and visit the guys you've locked up, and that's cool. That's really fun. But then, like, there's no visit to Gordon. There's no visit to Tim. There's no visit to Dick. The other thing I was going to say, Dick Grayson is amazing in this game. In the main story and the DLC, he's my favorite character in comics, as many people know. This version of Dick Grayson is amazing. Love it. The voice, the character, his relationship with Bruce, it's amazing. And it only upsets me that they didn't use him more in this series, because, gosh, that relationship is so vital to the mythos. And I love the way they use him when he is here, that I wish we could have gotten more of him. But that's the other thing I love about this. The tandem gameplay stuff, Nick, was so fun.
Oh, yes. It would be a really good foundation for an eventual multiplayer entry into the series, or an optional multiplayer entry. Maybe not, you know, forced multiplayer, but something you could potentially play with friends if you wanted them to jump in on your campaign for a little while, play online, whatever. And maybe we'll see that. I mean, the Arkham series, I don't think is dead. I think we're sure to see an Arkham series, an Arkham game, sooner rather than later, probably. WB Montreal has been teasing something with their teaser images on Twitter that are clearly Batman-related. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Quick highlights for me. The Hush. There's a Hush side mission in the game that I don't want to get real little too much about, but it's awesome. The battle between Batman and the Arkham Knight is very difficult and very fun in a challenging way. The big finale for Scarecrow is very satisfying. And the Mr. Freeze DLC is a really awesome story. And then the other DLC, Red Hood. There's a Red Hood level you get to play, and it's so fun. I mean, I never knew it could be so much fun to break Black Mask's thugs' necks and shoot them in the head. But it is. So anyway, great game. Really glad I played it. Now I'm just got to move on to whatever the next one is. I think I'm going to do Telltale Batman next. So,
ooh, I would say do Spider-Man.
I just know it's such an investment, you know, of time and energy on those, because it's going to, and then I'm going to have to relearn mechanics, because I just relearned Arkham, and now I'm going to have to learn a whole new style of mechanics.
Oh, yes. It is very, it's different. Like, it's similar, but it is different enough that, like, because I remember when I first started playing Spider-Man, I could tell that the controls were similar to Arkham, and I was like, oh, well, I'll just play this like I do Arkham and spam the counter button, and it took me a while to learn how to play the game. But once I did, I was like, oh, man, this is really fun.
You know, it also took the World Wrestling Federation a long time to figure out how to play the game.
That's true.
Well, with that being said, I can't help but notice the time, Nick.
Yeah, the time. Look at the time.
The time is...
Oh, God, yes.
What is going on over here? Nick, I'm getting something over here on the other side of the L-shaped studio. It's coming out of the fax machine. Nope, sorry. It's the Ho-Ho Loon ticker!
Yes.
All right, this is just in.
Still exists.
Ho-Ho Loon biography still exists on the award-winning WWE Network.
There you go.
Wow. Go figure.
Who would have thunk it?
Jeez. Ho-Ho Loon. Wow. Amazing. Well, also, folks, it is time for the Wrestling Minute. And, you know, the Royal Rumble has come and gone. We talked about that last week, and now we're building on the road to WrestleMania in WWE. Drew McIntyre headed for a collision with Brock Lesnar, but first, the Beast is going to take on Ricochet in Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We've got, looks like...
And Ricochet is getting the rub, Greg, don't forget.
LOL, never change, as they say. And by the way, yes, I think Ricochet is getting the rub. He's wrestling Brock Lesnar. And it will probably be good. Unless they go the Kofi route, which I don't think they will.
Not the full Kofi route, but I'm thinking something relatively short.
It will be relatively short, but I could easily see Ricochet going the same length that Finn Balor went at the Rumble last year, about 9 minutes or so. And making it pretty good, because I think Ricochet's excellent in the ring, is all I'm going to say. So there's no reason it can't be a fun match. Brock versus small guys, very fun. And then you've got, looks like Charlotte Flair and Rhea Ripley on a collision course, potentially.
That is the way it seems.
Which I'm excited about. And, you know, the rumors would have you believe that Becky Lynch and Shayna Baszler could be on a collision course. We don't know. That has not been determined yet officially. Rumors would also have you believe that Bayley and Sasha could be on a collision course. Again, just rumors. Roman Reigns and The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, could be on a collision course. So, to me, WrestleMania right now, Nick, is shaping up pretty well. I'm pretty excited about this card if it holds together the way that it's looking.
Yeah, an influx of new talent, you know, onto the card, new matchups, fresh stuff. I'm pretty excited.
On the undercard, I believe we're going to get EC3 and Drake Maverick against Ramblin' Rabbit and Huskus the Pig. So that should be fun. And yeah, so that's the WWE side of things. AEW is rolling right along on the path to Revolution, their next pay-per-view event. Once again, located in Chicago. And that will be main evented by Chris Jericho and Jon Moxley in one of the best built feuds in wrestling right now. They've built up a huge issue with one another. Mox is selling it well. He's wrestling with an eye patch after Jericho stabbed his eye with this metal spike a la the Road Warriors on Dusty Rhodes in 88. So I'm excited about that one. MJF and Cody are building towards one hell of a blood feud there. And the tag division's been shaken up by the unlikely pairing of Hangman Page, who's suddenly become a red-hot babyface in the midst of a planned heel turn alongside Kenny Omega. So what are your thoughts on the AEW landscape there, Nick?
Yeah, Hangman Page has got it. I mean, you know, right now their main event scene, and this is not to knock Moxley or Jericho, who are both doing great, and the feud's been good, and I'm excited for the match. But right now, if I'm AEW and I'm building long term, I am doing everything in my power to continue to get over Hangman Page as a babyface and MJF as a heel and keeping them apart, because that's your future right there, in my estimation.
I can't disagree with you, man. He's that scene from last week where he comes in and does the buckshot lariat while making Matt Jackson hold his beer, and then grabbing it and finishing the beer while he just leaves the arena nonchalant. That was some cool shit in a way that wrestling has a hard time pulling off a lot of times. That was some Steve Austin or The Rock kind of swag right there. So yeah, I was down with that. So I'm happy with Hangman. If the plan was to turn him heel, I'm taking a U-turn on that. And I'm turning Kenny and the Bucks heel and keeping Hangman as the badass babyface.
I agree.
All right. With that being said, that is the end of the Wrestling Minute, and that's about the end of the episode, I believe. So we'll catch you next week.
No, Greg, we got to finish this episode as we do each and every week. You almost forgot that. Standing by, we have WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. Jim Ross, by the way, JR, I understand you're recently back from your trip to Miami. You were in attendance for the Super Bowl
between the
Chiefs, 49ers, and
a lot of Sooners in that game.
You were also a lot of Sooners. That's true, but you were also in attendance for the halftime show, which has been getting a lot of buzz online. Yeah. Jennifer Lopez, Shakira. I know you're a big fan of both those ladies.
Yeah, two great talents.
And so, yeah, and I figured while you were there, you couldn't help but probably sing along to some of their songs and man, why should that only exist in that moment, that time, and that place? We need to get that captured for a little bit of posterity, you know, get that on tape. And so I figured, why not have you do one of their one of Shakira's more popular songs? So Jim, take it away.
I got to be honest with you, I'm having a hard time carrying a tune right about now, but I'll do my best here. Now I'm gonna, you can't see it, but I'm trying to shake a little bit with this song too. Now I'm trying to add a little bit of JR wiggle to it. So keep that in mind, in your mind's eye. You got it in your mind's eye, Nick?
Yes.
All right, there, Connie. Now. Ladies up in here tonight, no fighting. We got the refugees up in here, no fighting, no fighting. Shakira, I never knew that she could dance like this. She makes a man want to speak Spanish. Homo, si, lama, bonita, mi casa, su casa, cc. Oh, baby, when you talk to Shakira, you make a woman go mad. So be wise and keep on reading the signs of my body. I'm on tonight. You know that my hips don't lie and I'm starting to feel it's right. All the attraction, the tension. Don't you see, baby? This is perfection. Hey, girl, I can see your body moving. And it's driving my ass crazy. And I didn't have the slightest idea until I saw you dancing. When you walk up on that dance floor, nobody cannot ignore the way that you move your body. And everything is so unexpected now. It swerves in the right places, folks. It's logical. I never really knew the way you write and dance left like this. So you can keep on shaking it. She makes a man want to speak Spanish. Como se llama bonita. Mi casa, si casa, si si. When you talk like that, you make a woman go mad.
Oh, baby!
So be wise and keep on reading the signs of my body. I'm on tonight. You know, my hips don't lie, and I'm starting to feel you, boy. Come on, let's go. Come on, let's go. Don't you see, baby? I see es perfecto. If I know I am on tonight, my hips don't lie. And I'm starting to feel that it is right. All of the attraction, tension. Do not you see, baby? This is perfection. Oh, boy, I can see your body moving. Half animal, Batista. Half man, Becky Lynch. I don't really know what I'm doing. But you seem to have a plan. A game plan. A cerebral plan, like the cerebral sap. You gotta have a game plan out there. Sometimes you gotta grab a side headlock instead of shaking your ass back and forth. My will and self-restraint come to fail now. Fail now. See, I am doing what I can, but I can't. So, you know, that's a bit too hard to explain. Baila en la calle de noche. Vaya en la calle de no día. Vaya en la calle de noche. Vaya en la calle de día. I never really knew that she could dance like this. She makes a man want to speak Spanish. Como se llama, Anita, mi casa, su casa, Shakira. Oh, baby, when you talk like that, you know that you have me hypnotized. Be wise, keep on breathing in the signs of my body. Señorita, feel the conga. Let me see you move like you come from Colombia. Mi vida en Barranquilla, se vaya a si se. In Barranquilla, se vaya a si. Yes, she is so sexy. Every man's fantasy. A refugee like me back with the Fugees from a third world country. I go back like when Pack carried crates for Humpty Hump. We leave the whole club this. Why the CIA want to watch up? Colombians and Haitians, anybody can contribute to this business. I ain't guilty. Musical transaction. No more do we run the road. Refugees run the seas. I'm on tonight, boat. And you know that old JR's hit. And I'm starting to feel you, boy. Come on, let's go real slow. Maybe like this is perfection. No fighting now. Oh, you know I'm on tonight. My hips don't lie. I'm starting to feel that it is right. The attraction, gotta have an attraction. Tension, baby, this is like perfection. No fighting, no fighting. Quite frankly, ain't no damn fight.
Our traveling fanboys.